We're going to begin by opening a work session on Senate Bill 267. Open a work session on 267.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 267 has been presented and passed, so you may all be familiar with it, but for those of you who are not, it would allow the tax court to determine the real market value or correct valuation of property that is subject to special assessment based on evidence before the court without regard to the values pled by parties. Basically, as background on this case, just to give you some background on the case, previously the tax court had this authority to look beyond the pleadings. In the event that new evidence were presented in the court, it could consider that additional evidence, and sometimes it might want to move outside the pleadings for a ruling. But in 1997, some legislation was passed, basically in the process of creating a magistrate's division, and the section that gave the tax court authority to rule beyond the pleadings was inadvertently repealed. So this bill basically would reinstate that previous authority.
Are there questions? The members remember our testimony on this issue. I think one of the things that we heard was that the judge might ask the party to amend their pleading so that they could go outside of what was originally pled as a way of rectifying this. I think that giving them authority to move outside based on the evidence is probably prudent. Senator Decker?
Thank you. I have spoken with Jenny Lang from Quest, and they have dropped their objection, and that was, we were going to move the bill last time, but wanted to at least consider their objection, and since then, they have removed that objection.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Brzezinski.
Looking at what we had on that last meeting, there was a proposed amendment. I don't know if that's still something that needed to be included or not, because it looks like I don't have any amendments in the packet, so I don't know if we're just moving the original bill. Just want to make sure we move the right thing.
The chair has just told us that he talked with Jenny, and they withdrew the notion of
I didn't know where that one
amendment.
Came from. Okay. Sorry.
To entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brzezinski.
I've moved Senate Bill 267 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Brzezinski has moved Senate Bill 267 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Do we have a volunteer carrier?
Oh, sure.
Oh, sure. Thanks, Senator Brzezinski. We'll carry. Thank you.
This one's got writing all over it. I can tell now.
With that, we'll move on, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 22. Mr. Warner.
Chair, I'm sitting in for Mazin, who is ill this week. But as you recall, Senate Bill 22 was a bill that came to you from the Treasurer, and the main element of it is to remove a portion of current statute that prevents the investment officer from performing certain functions. Those are laid out, and if you look at Section 1, Sub 2, of Senate Bill 22, you can see the elements there that are prevented in current statute. Basically, this would allow the state treasurer to invest in certain funds and in common stock. So the issue that came up during that discussion you had earlier on the bill was, what is the current practice in other states? Is this a common feature? Is there direct ownership of equities in other state treasuries around the country? And you requested that the Treasury do a survey or bring you back information on that. That is in your packets, a February 14 memo from the Treasury addressed to the committee. So I think they are here to walk through that with you.
Let's do that. Would you please come forward?
Good morning. Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Mueller, the Assistant Director of Investments at the Oregon State Treasury. What I'd like to do is just quickly walk through the summary of the survey that we conducted. We sent a survey to other states, other state pension funds, asking them whether in-house investing was allowed, and if so, what parameters or limits were placed on that ability. 21 states responded to the survey. However, one of those states that responded is only allowed to invest in debt or bond securities, so we discounted their response. So the remaining 20 responses, and I'd like to point out that some of the states that responded included the Texas Teachers Retirement System, the Pennsylvania State Employees Retirement System, the Missouri State Employees Retirement System, Kansas PERS, and our neighbors to the south, the California State Teachers Retirement System. Obviously, there are other states that also allow this, but these are some of the ones that responded to the survey. So of the 20 responses, I'll highlight, summarize what they allow. 18 states allow direct ownership of equities. Currently, the state participates in equity security ownership, obviously, but it's done through outside management firms. So what this bill would allow is for us to retain in-house staff to do that. And the way I view it is it's another tool in our investment tool belt, if you will, that would allow us to avail ourselves of an investment opportunity that we may be able to do so at a lower cost. So 18 funds are managed by investment boards that are combined with a PERS administrative office. Only two are part of an elected official's office like Oregon. Of the 18 that are allowed to run portfolios internally, 10 actually do so. And the average range of internal management is from 62%, that's the average with a range of 10 to 100%. Of the 10 with internal management, 4 run passive or market index portfolios. 3 run enhanced index portfolios, which are similar to passive portfolios but with a slightly higher risk. And then 2 run what we call fully active portfolios, where your tracking error, the risk that you take relative to the benchmark, is substantially higher. All 10 are satisfied with the performance of their internal operations. We also talked about the ability to run in-house real estate or private equity portfolios on a co-investment basis, and 5 funds do that of the 20. Only one of the funds has a statutory limit on the amount that can be invested internally, and in terms of statutory restrictions on safeguards on internal management, they're typically limited to the prudent investor standard, which we currently operate under ORS 293.726. So that's our guiding principle, and I would think that any restrictions should be placed in policy as opposed into law. Of the states that do have restrictions, they run the gamut from Tennessee, which does not allow any in-state investing relative to this program, and another state which doesn't allow the use of in-state brokers in their program. All funds obviously have policies that create guidelines on things like allowable investments, portfolio characteristics, and the diversification requirements, and certainly anything in this program would be run through the Oregon Investment Council. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Senator Metzger, does this answer your questions?
The information is helpful. You know, it's good to get a broad spectrum of what other people are doing. You know, I still have my concern, and I told the chair, you know, I would support the bill, but I and you know, it'd be interesting to see on the House side whether there may be something there. I'm still very, very, you know, interested. I'm still a little cautious in terms of direct investments without having a track record here of how that might play out. I would be very, very interested, even if it's not in the language of the bill, to have the Treasurer's Office on record that that the legislature would be provided a summary of the direct investments that were made under the provisions of this bill in the next legislative session, so that we have a way of looking at what the Treasurer elected to do and to what portion of the portfolio was direct invested. I think that information would be valuable, even if it isn't in statute, and I would like to have a commitment from the Treasurer's Office that they will return to the next legislative assembly and give us an analysis of how they utilize the provisions of this legislation. And that would be satisfactory to me, Mr. Vice Chair, at this point, if we would get that commitment.
Yeah, Vice Chair Starr, Senator Metzger, we'd be happy to do that. Currently, all our performance is posted quarterly on our website, but we could certainly come back. And again, we may not even use this avenue of investing in the next legislative session, but we can report that back, or we will certainly report back the success of the program or its implementation.
Senator Beckett.
Thank you, Vice Chair. So the thought I have now, because we were trying, when we first had this, we were thinking, well, what walls, for lack of a better word, can we put into place, just not for this treasurer, but for future treasurers?
Well, why not for this treasurer?
Well, this treasurer also. But when Paul and I were discussing this, we thought, okay, we've got this one, and then we have future treasurers, and we want to ensure that we have protections in place. So perhaps, and we could bump this along, but get an amendment that would be offered up to the House Revenue Committee that would say they will formally report, not ask this one to commit, because I think they would, but have a formal report given with this type of investment, made perhaps to, you know, the Senate President and the House Speaker and the two chairs of revenue. I don't know what a fair time period. We don't want to burden you with work, and we wouldn't want to. But every 2 years,
before we come into session, and we can always remove that after a period of time if things seem to be running smoothly and there's no issues for this treasurer ones in the future.
Yeah, Vice Chair Starr, Senator Deckard, we'd have no problem doing that. We'd be happy to. No objection.
Well, I rather like that approach, and I think that it's good to have a reporting requirement. We can move the bill, and we can suggest that it be looked at from that standpoint as it moves through the process. If there's no further discussion, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Przanski.
I'd move Senate Bill 22 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski has moved Senate Bill 22 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Is there any opposition? Hearing none, so ordered. Carrier? Vice Chair will carry. We will now open a hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will now open a hearing on Senate Bill 302.
Mr. Chair, we're calling Senator Walker's office, and she hopefully will be joining us shortly on Senate Bill 302. What the bill does is go through and make some modifications to the membership, and particularly the term limits, creates term limits for the Oregon Investment Council. What it does is limit the term of each appointed investment council member to two full terms in a 12-year period. So that would be two 4-year terms in that 12-year period. Limits the number of years of the Oregon Investment Council to no more than 4 years in the 12-year period. And also has a requirement for recordings and a written log of the Oregon Investment Council meetings to be available to the public by the following meeting of the council. So, in other words, those minutes or recordings are going to be released no later than the next investment council meeting. I can't remember, there's actually a similar provision in the Federal Reserve you may be familiar with, that the open market committee meetings are minutes are available at the time of the next meeting. And it also specifies our investment council shall meet at least once every month and dates and times determined by the council. So basically what it does is make some modifications to the investment council that Treasury referred to as the managers of the state portfolio.
Mr. Vice Chair?
Yes, Senator Prosansky.
I wonder if Paul could just walk us through. I mean, some of the other changes, I understand the term limits is something that's new. At least it doesn't appear to be in place now, or I misread it. And then the other part was how often or how frequently does the council meet now?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we have the Treasury here can come up and talk to how the investment council currently operates. And we have Kate Richardson here.
Yes. Welcome to the committee, Kate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice Chair. Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff of the Oregon State Treasurer. In answer to Senator Prosansky's question about current practice, I will say just overall looking at this bill, most of these things are just a codification of our current policy. Mm-hmm. So most of these things are already happening. The one piece that is not is the monthly meetings. However, it has been the council's practice to meet monthly. In this next year, the calendar has, looking back over the schedules, et cetera, the council has chosen to schedule 8 longer regular meetings over the course of the year. And that's the one piece of this bill that the Treasury is here to ask if the requirement for monthly meetings, if that could be amended out, in that if there isn't business for a meeting, it doesn't warrant the cost of having a monthly meeting.
So if I can understand, Mr. Vice Chair, if I can follow up.
Yes.
Regarding the terms and stuff, it's in policy, so this is by rule?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Prosansky, it's by policy, not by administrative rule. The terms are as laid out here, the 2 terms in a 12-year period, 2 4-year terms in a 4-year period, and also the limitation on the chairship, those are in policy. However, it is the governor as the appointing authority, and so it would, of course, be his prerogative to trump that. So this would be actually a limitation on the governor's authority for appointment. We are not opposing this since it reflects a general policy that was put into place, I think, in the prior administration.
If I could follow up one other question.
Yes, Senator Prosansky.
My only concern is that when we put stuff like this, of course, codifying it does not give us any flexibility, and I'm wondering if there's any history as to the term or the length of memberships, if this is something that we should be concerned with, because if you have people that are, as the president would say, certified smart in an area, and you're talking about making these type of investments and decisions, it just seems to me that you want people that are definitely knowledgeable in those areas, and that we're not having a, I'm going to call it a revolving door, understanding that it sounds like it may be policy now, and I just want to make certain that we don't put something in place that sounds good, looks good on paper, but actually could be a negative impact on the state's ability to have an investment council that can actually do the best work for the state.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Prosansky, we share your concern. This is an active council, and it requires a fair amount of expertise. The policy reflects an earlier administration's choice, it does not restrict currently the governor in that appointment. We share your concern. It did not rise to the level of opposing the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions, Senator?
I don't actually have any questions, but just thoughts since Senator Walker isn't here. On its face, I don't oppose the term limit of, you know, essentially 8 years in a 12-year period, which means someone would serve under this. It would be a maximum. Actually, it wouldn't be a maximum because it's two full terms. Someone could be appointed to fill a vacancy. So someone could conceivably serve 10 years and have to take 4 years off and could be reappointed. So I don't see that, unlike, say, term limits for legislators in which, you know, you never come back. I mean, I don't see that as a real problem there. I would have some reticence, as Kay mentioned, regarding the monthly meetings, because not being familiar with all the workings of the Investment Council, it's hard for me to judge the necessity of that they have to meet monthly. I mean, I don't have the expertise to say that. It may be a good idea. They certainly have the ability to call themselves whenever needed now. I'd hate to have somebody meeting because the statute required them to meet and expend money from the funds for no particular purpose. So that would be the only thing I would be concerned about, is, you know, making people meet because the law says we have to meet. And I don't know if that's a good policy.
Yes. Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Metzger, to speak to your issue, we have spoken with Senator Walker, and I won't testify for her, but I think there was some concern expressed, or the genesis for this piece was the discussion that of moving to an eight meeting schedule for this year. But there was some concern, perhaps, that if there had to be a meeting in between those, you know, meetings 2 and 3, that those would be addressed by teleconference. However, the Oregon Investment Council is subject to the public meetings law, and even if they do hold, and this wouldn't restrict a telemeeting, we always provide a place for the public to attend those meetings. It's usually at the Purvis Building, and those are open to the public, as all of our Oregon Investment Council meetings are.
Further questions?
Clarification, if I could.
Please.
Regarding the request from the treasurer's office as to this monthly meeting, what would you propose that we use? Do a monthly meeting unless it's not necessary, or do you think to leave it more, or just take it out completely and allow the process to work under the policies that are currently in place?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Przanski, it would be our preference to remove that and allow the business of the Oregon Investment Council to drive the meeting schedule.
Okay.
But historically speaking, it has I don't think there's ever been less than 8 meetings in a year's period. Most members that serve on the Investment Council are very busy people, and it's not a large group, so sometimes you do and sometimes there are vacancies, and we do have quorum concerns mm-hmm. at certain time periods as well.
I have another question.
Senator Metzger.
Are they diligent about posting their meetings for public? I mean, some organizations aren't, I've found. So, you know, you find them on their webpage the day after the meeting. So mm-hmm. What is your experience with that?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Metzger, thank you very much for the question. It would be rather dangerous for me to say we aren't diligent. Indeed, we are. We post regularly. In fact, they go up on our agendas, go up on our website, and there's also a mailing list for all agendas. Our minutes are posted no less than the next meeting up on our website as well. As the minutes are approved by the next council, and they're posted on our website. On all of our agendas and meeting minutes are on our website.
Just how much in advance of a meeting do you generally have that information available?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Metzger, I believe it's 2 weeks.
Okay.
2 weeks for a mailing to the OIC members and 1 week for the posting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I have a question. Looking under Section 1, Sub 2 says the governor shall appoint 4 voting members, be qualified by training and experience in the field of investment or finance, and who may not hold any other public office or employment. Then we go to Section 2, sub 2A says one member must be a person who is appointed to serve on the Public Employee Retirement Board. And it seems to me that there's a contradiction between those two sections. Would you address that, please?
Mr. Vice Chair, you should be a lawyer. It does. I believe, though, that this is this in Section 2, that current part of the statute, I think, has been interpreted not to conflict with that prior statement earlier. So it is the exception to this.
Should we not make that exception clear, or does this, in fact, make it clear?
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, the that exception has been in place for quite some time, so it has been, I don't think it's been operating as a barrier.
I hate to see contradictions in the statute. I think that is a contradiction.
Mr. Vice Chair, we would not be opposed to making it more clear.
I would suggest that as we look at amendment that we might do that so that that is cleared up and not contradictory.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I agree with you. I mean, I'm looking at Section 1 versus Section 2, and it's almost duplicitous as to, and one of them has more of a qualifier on it than the other.
Mm-hmm.
I question the need for the two separate sections. It seems like you could go with just basically Section 2, because you're going to get the governor report, shall appoint the four members, and then you have the specifics there as compared to the one that's above it, at least for that portion as to what the governor's duties are. It looks like the same one.
Senator Walker, welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, and your chair has arrived. I apologize for the delay. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator in District 7, and there was a miscommunication in my office about when this bill was up for hearing, so I'm a little bit unprepared this morning, other than I can, and I don't know what has been testified to previously. Let me just give you some background as to why I introduced this bill. I call all my OIC bills the Diana Goldschmidt bills, because as many of you know, she served on the Oregon Investment Council, and there were some very interesting things that occurred during her period of service. One of the things that I learned during her period of service is that the Investment Council has a standard of ethics policy, and it is somewhere in this file, which I'm trying to find. But it exists, and it's something that the council put together itself. And that standard of ethics policy sets the terms by which members may serve and sets the terms by which they may serve as chair. But there's also a little caveat in one of the policies that says that all of those things may be waived by the council, by a majority vote of the council. Well, I found that to be very interesting and inappropriate. I don't think that people should be able to waive their standard of ethics just because they think it's a good idea, because they happen to like the chair of the council. The reason we don't allow someone to serve more than that period of time as chair is because these people are dealing with billions of state dollars. We're not talking millions. We're talking billions of dollars in investment money. It is extremely important that someone not become chair and stay there for a long period of time, build up some kind of influence, and have their position compromised. This council has had problems with that in the past, and it's in my file, and if I had been more prepared, I would be able to give you that information. What I propose doing is writing a memo to the committee and explaining to you some of the background.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brzezinski.
Since Senator Walker wasn't here at the beginning, it might be fruitful for her to know that the treasurer's come in and they're not opposed to any of the bill with the exception of the monthly meeting. And so it seems to me that it seems like the parties that are involved are willing to have it codified as to what their policy has been.
Mm-hmm.
The only concern has been as to
the monthly meeting issue.
Right.
And I've had discussions with the treasurer's office that the monthly meeting issue is a problem for them because they may not have business every single month. And I would be willing to do that, to acquiesce to that condition. I just need to make it really clear, however. I don't want this meaning that we're going to have conference calls by telephone with members and having meetings done that way, because that does not allow the public an opportunity to participate and to listen in to what these folks are doing on these conference calls. So I actually would like the department to address that issue, whether you are participating in conference calls, whether you notice those as public meetings, and how you can do that and still meet the Oregon public meetings law.
Yes.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, as we spoke a little bit earlier, but Senator Decker was outside as well, all of our meetings are scheduled in our in-person meetings. They are noticed according to the requirements of the public meetings law. When there is occasion, for instance, in between meetings or for some event to be held by teleconference, which is allowed by the public meetings law, those are noticed in the very same manner. There is also a physical location for the public to come and attend those meetings. Sometimes there may be even a member of the council in attendance, but those are public meetings in accordance with the public meetings law and are treated no differently. I will, though, emphasize that the council does meet in person the vast majority of the time.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Ms. Richardson would be the first to agree that the council did have a meeting, which was the meeting that created the controversy in October, that wasn't publicly noticed as a meeting. It was a training session.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, that meeting was indeed a public meeting, and it was noticed in accordance with the public meetings law.
But there were no minutes, audio minutes taken.
The public meetings law does not require audio recordings. It requires minutes to be taken, and there were minutes taken at that meeting.
And, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that's why we have this bill today, because I think it's important that we have those audio meetings similar to what we do here. Everything we do here, there are minutes being taken by our committee assistant, and there are audio recordings, and they're actually quite entertaining to listen to later, especially over a period of time. I've been listening to some audio tapes from 15 years ago, and that's fascinating. So I'm trying to be very careful about what I say on the record anymore, because it picks up everything we say. So I think that we're in agreement then on everything, as long as we have opportunity for public participation in phone conferences.
Yeah, I know. Mr. Vice Chair, I do want to emphasize that it is our policy to tape all of our meetings, and we do have audio recordings going back many years. In fact, this was an exception. This was an off-site workshop, not a business meeting, and there was not audio equipment available at the site. I don't expect we will be doing that in the future. As I said, most of our, in fact, all of them, that's the only one I know that doesn't have an audio recording.
Thank you. Further question, Senator Metzger.
I don't have a question, but since Senator Walker was not here earlier, and Senator Prozanski, I think, kind of set the table for that. But just to make it clear with Senator Walker, I think these points, in my viewpoint, are very valid, and I think it's a good piece of legislation. Other than, I also express the same concern mentioned by Senator Prozanski, that I'm not interested in putting in statute that someone has to meet, so that, you know, people meet because it's in statute they have to meet and incur that kind of cost. I am concerned that they are noticed properly, that that the public has an opportunity to attend, that the public has an opportunity to hear if they were not able to attend. All those other provisions of what you have in this piece of legislation, I think, are excellent. The only thing I would ask is that we don't necessarily have a meetings set by statute. I hate to have people sitting around saying, well, the law made us come and we didn't have anything to do here in December. So other than that, I think it's excellent, and I think your points are valid.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I'm willing to draft and have an amendment drafted to remove that requirement. And I don't know, I came into the middle of the discussion about the concern you had between Section 1 and Section 2. Ms. Richardson wants to speak to that.
Mr. Vice Chair, and Senator Posonski, to your point, I brought my statutes with me. And Section 2 are amendments that will become effective in 2007.
Okay.
So those are actually not part of current statute right now, but the way they look in our bill, it looks like we have duplications.
We didn't look at the fine print somewhere.
And it is fine print.
But need the glasses for that.
I actually need glasses on my stubble.
Further discussion? I think we need some amendments here. Mr. Warner will work.
Will you take care of that?
Work for the.
I can do. I'll work with Senator Walker's office. It's. It looks to me, Mr. Chair, like it's really just Section 6, in which is where you have the monthly requirement. I think that's the only place where that appears.
Correct.
So, but I will work with Senator Walker's office on that, make sure Council has that drawn up.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, would it's my understanding then you'd like to delete the entire Section 6? Because there is a part in that that says the Council may meet at other times in places specified by the call of the Chair or a majority of the members of the Council. Do you think that that's necessary, Ms. Richardson?
Mr. Vice Chair, I believe that authority already exists.
Open of current statutes. Mm-hmm. Thanks. All right. Then I would be amenable to just deleting Section 6.
Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. So, I'm fine with deleting the monthly meeting. I'm also, just I guess on the point that Senator Metzger made, I'm always leery about putting things in statute, and I'm thinking of the chair position, just limiting those and knowing that once we put that in, it's permanent, that now we've limited that chair. And I guess I haven't heard the rationale. It seems to be a fine requirement, but I always think of the circumstances where we might have a fantastic chair who's just doing a wonderful job, and all parties seem to agree that this individual should continue on because they're interested, they're good, and I guess that's the only thought that lingers in the back of my mind, Senator Walker, is do we want to codify that language, which is, I guess, from what I understand, but I'm not sure, is a practice that it's not in statute.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I would like to respond to that the Oregon Investment Council came up with the standard of ethics. I spoke to Bill Rutherford, who was a former state treasurer, who actually brought those standard of ethics to my attention and said they were instituted during his tenure. I think they're very good ethical standards to maintain the integrity of the council and not have undue influence on folks who deal with billions of dollars in state investments. And I can cite you back, I just don't have it in my file, to a time where we had a chair, I think, who served about 12 years. And I believe it was after that time period that this standard of ethics was implemented. That's an entirely too long a period to have someone, even though they're doing a good job. You can build subtle means of influence in a position like that, and it is not appropriate. And this state has 3.5 million people in it. And that's what frustrates me about how we recycle people on boards and commissions, because we have a state full of very talented individuals. And if the council felt that was a standard of ethics that was important then, it should be important now, but it shouldn't be waivable. I don't think that they should be able to waive those ideas. And frankly, the current chair of the Investment Council, Jerry Drummond, was brought back with the express purpose of serving as chair. I have a copy of a letter from Governor Kitzhaber's file that Mr. Drummond submitted to the governor and said, it is my understanding I am being brought back on the council to serve as chair and that you will discuss that with the other members. And I believe Mr. Drummond serves in violation of the current ethics policies. But because those policies can be waived by a vote of the members, there was nothing that I could do about it. And I just don't think it's appropriate. I think we really need to maintain integrity in that process. And the council serves, well, we were a model for the country. The Oregon Investment Council was a model for the country when we began what we were doing. And I believe we should be above reproach. And I have another bill that's Diana Goldschmidt Part 2 bill that you'll probably be hearing as well that requires council members to notify Treasury and the council and the council chair of potential conflicts of interest within one business day of their knowledge of that. Because Ms. Goldschmidt did not do that for about 20 days, and it brought significant embarrassment to the Oregon Investment Council that none of them felt comfortable with. So, you know, I think this is a really good piece of legislation and good government, and it's something that council is already living by.
Further discussion. I'd again like to bring our attention back to the current conflicts between the two sections there, that and ask that we have that addressed.
Matt's all open that up,
Senator Krasinski. Yes.
Kate, looking at the bill as it's drafted, it doesn't say that Section 2 goes into effect. I understand you've got something in front of you that actually shows that it's been codified previously. I guess the question is, if it's already there and it's supposed to go into effect in 2007, is there a reason why we could not just have it be implemented sooner, or is it because of the membership we'd be out of compliance with the code?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Przanski, this was part of the PERS reform.
Mm-hmm.
And there in the past, there had been a member of the PERS board that would serve on the OIC. But when the PERS board was diminished in size, there wasn't, and then a whole new board created, there was not a person who could serve in that crossover position. And we did not want to lose that potential going mm-hmm. forward to have a board member that would serve on both. So this was the compromise that was worked out regarding that by postponing that requirement that there be a member from the PERS board and serving also on the OIC to a date in the future. I think it was impeding the recruitment of new PERS board members. And that function is being served primarily right now by the service of Mark Gardner on our Oregon Investment Council. He's a prior member of the PERS board, so the crossover experience is there. But the reason this is postponed to go into effect is to remove that requirement.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I found the letter in my file from Mr. Drummond to Governor Kitzhaber dated April 20th, 2001, where he writes, I am writing this following our telephone conversation today during which you expressed your desire that I return to the Oregon Investment Council as its chair. Based on that conversation, it is my expectation to be appointed to the council effective June 1, 2001, assuming confirmation. And by that time, you will have talked to those members of the council with whom you have not already discussed my return for the OIC as chair. It was very clear Mr. Drummond wanted to return to the council only in that capacity. It's fascinating. I might just, as a side note, tell you it is absolutely fascinating to go over to the Archives Division and check review the files that they have on hand from our former governors. It's fascinating material in there. And, in fact, I will be the first to tell you that Governor Goldschmidt's files will now be going up on the web from the Archives Division. They have copied every image, and you will be able to get those on the web now instead of going and sitting in their building, which actually is quite lovely, but most of us don't have all that time. Anyway, I did find that letter, and I would also, what I will do, Mr. Chair, since you've expressed just a teensy bit of nervousness about that, is provide you with some information about the previous investment council where the chair had spent a great deal of time as chair, and some of the investment problems that they had, just to illustrate to you why it's, I think that's why the council liked these policies.
Thank you. Kate, do you have something to add?
Mr. Vice Chair, if we are going to be putting an amendment, there is one that I might, one more little one that I might add, and it may be going to a clarification to that Section 2. As the current Section 1 reads, four voting members who are qualified by training and experience in the field of investment or finance. In Section 2, when it's allowing a member from the PERS board, it removes the requirement for the field of investment or finance on that member. It would be our preference that the PERS board member be a person that was also, we wouldn't lose the expertise. So I understand why it in Section 2B, it does drop to three members must be qualified, but it would be our preference to have the PERS board member also be qualified in investment and finance.
I would concur wholeheartedly with that, and thank Ms. Richardson for catching that. That's a very, very good element to put in the bill.
Thank you. I think we've explored this thoroughly. We will be bringing this back when we have some amendments, and thank you very much, Senator Walker, for bringing it before us. No further business. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 302.
Great.
Mr. Chair, do you have any, or Mr. Warner, any announcements?
Just a reminder that the committee will not be meeting tomorrow. The next meeting is scheduled for Monday. We will post the schedule here, hopefully, by the end of the day.
I'm not going to miss it. Well, you know, we canceled because we had two people in Pendleton, but now we understand we don't have two people in Pendleton tomorrow.
Correct.
So we'll have to cancel again in March.
Looks like that might happen, except that it's not clear to me whether we're meeting on Thursday or the 17th or Friday the 18th in Pendleton.
I can help with that. And we actually travel date for the two judiciary committees, both the House and the Senate, will be on Wednesday the 16th. We meet on the 17th, and we're back in Salem that evening of the 17th.
Okay, so we should get this down, because if we lose, if we lose two of our members, it obviously constricts our ability. Okay, so you, for sure, that on March...
Travel the 16th.
So you're on March 16th, correct?
Well, no, we will leave in the afternoon.
Oh, okay, so the 17th.
Yeah.
My birthday.
No, what? Which one? The 17th?
Yeah, March 17th.
Okay, you're a
St.
Patty's birthday?
Man. Yeah.
Well, another thing I can mention, Mr. Chair, is that the Senate Business Committee, which I'm a member of, is meeting on the 18th, on Friday, in Hood River. So on your way back from Pendleton, you can join the Business Committee. And maybe we can have a joint revenue committee. We can just cover it all, I think, in that 24-hour period.
Business and judiciary.
Efficiency.
Yeah, efficiency, government efficiency.
Could I make one more schedule?
Yes.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that the schedule for next week will be a little different, that there will be no meeting on Thursday, but a meeting on Friday morning for the March revenue forecast release.
Well, we may meet on Thursday.
Okay.
but, yeah, I don't think it looks like we'll just do the Friday revenue forecast meeting with the House.
Okay.
And no further business. The meeting is adjourned.
All right. Okay.